Are you sad at all about the M5 leaving?
You should pull the engine noise MP3s off the computer so you can play them anytime you want when you miss it.
So let's move on to something super exciting. Let's talk about SQL Server on Linux. I couldn't even get it out with a straight face. I tried so hard, I couldn't even do it. Oh,
well,
goodness.
This is kind of interesting, right? Because, like, you know, Microsoft has their database SQL Server, which for forever has required Windows Server. And I would imagine a lot of Windows Server licenses were exclusively to run Microsoft SQL Server. So them making this or announcing that it will be available for Linux is interesting, you know, because that means, again, like we brought up last week, how them bringing .NET to Linux officially would be, you know, interesting and might have a negative effect on their Windows Server licenses. This will probably have an even bigger negative effect on their Windows Server licenses. So I think what this is showing is that Microsoft would rather that you use .NET and use SQL Server rather than necessarily be stuck to Windows Server. And so all the reasons that people have for not using Microsoft Server products, now they have one big one less. Fewer?
Didn't they bring this up last week? I don't know. Maybe I'm misremembering, but I remember talking about the similar issues of like that Microsoft is becoming more friendly to Linux and how people don't like to run Linux servers and Windows servers. They're two kind of separate domains of knowledge. They'd rather just run all Linux servers. Linux is everywhere in the enterprise. And so that Microsoft could sell you, I think I might have said Exchange Server for Linux or something like that. But anyway, and also like that Microsoft could have its own Linux distro eventually. And it wasn't, you know, that was like last week. And then this announcement came. I mean, I'm sure this announcement was telegraphed for people who pay more attention to Microsoft than I do. But I had no awareness that they were even close to this. But then, you know, there it went right after last week's show. So it, and I think Christina Warren was also joking about a Microsoft Linux distro around the same time. I don't see that as implausible, although a couple of people from Microsoft tweeted, oh, you know, we partner with Red Hat and so on and so forth, and we let them do what they do best, which is do a Linux distro. We don't have one or whatever. But if Microsoft pursues this strategy to basically, we will sell you enterprise software, and we're not going to be super picky about where you run it. Like, if a lot of customers want to run our software on Linux, fine, we'll sell them a version to run on Linux, because they're not the everything Windows company anymore. I mean, they haven't been for a while now since Ballmer left, basically, or maybe even before.
Yeah, fair enough. It's an interesting push for sure, and I'm curious to see where this all ends up. But I like it. I think this is Microsoft playing to their strengths, which we've talked about, you know, several times on and off in the past. So good on Microsoft. Moving on, we got a lot of people that wrote in to talk about TV mounting over a fireplace, because unsurprisingly, a lot of people were perturbed at where I mount my TV. And we got two recurring links, which we'll put in the show notes. And it was Neil Weinstock that I guess was the first one in with these links. One of them is dynamic mounting, which is very similar to the other, which we received far more often, which is mantle mount. And the two of these things basically allow you to stuff the TV over the fireplace when it's not in use, but then drop it down kind of in front of the fireplace when you are using it. And these are very clever and things that I would never, ever bother with because I just don't care that much.
I would be so nervous about this. Like, I mean, again, I know that you can make a mount that's super strong and everything, but man, having the TV on the wall is bad enough. Having it like suspended on this arm that reaches like a couple of feet away from the wall. It's like thinking about like the stresses on that mount. Oh my God. I could not sleep at night with that above my TV. Or on my
TVs are light, it would be fine. But it is kind of weird, though, because your room looks weird with your TV kind of hanging in front of the fireplace. Like, I guess it's kind of a solution. And the idea is you can push it back up when you want the room to look nicer or whatever, but it still seems weird to me.
And then final piece of follow-up, I had tweeted a challenge to you / our mutual follows that here's the PDF of my owner's manual for my TV, make it work. I got a plethora of suggestions, most of which were actually very helpful, which I do appreciate, because oftentimes with Twitter, that's not the case. Tentatively, I think it may be fixed. It's been very not reliable. Sometimes it seems to be working right, sometimes not. When I say working right, what I mean is that it doesn't overscan or anything like that. It appears to be, I changed a million things at once because I'm a terrible debugger, apparently, when it comes to these sorts of things anyway. I think it is basically the showroom mode or something like it, or some sort of like, ooh, let me do everything automatically mode. When I first changed that, it didn't seem to make a difference. Then all of a sudden it seemed to be working. So gosh, only knows. But the positive sign so far. So thank you to the people on Twitter that had sent in some tips. And in theory, I think it might be better now.
So I think both you and Marco have had people download PDFs of things that you own and read them for you and tell you how to work them.
Yeah, and I think the common thread between us here is that we just don't care enough about this particular thing. Like, Marco does not care enough about well, but you should
about
care.
About finding the battery in his car? He cares.
Right, ish. And about knowing how to do shortcuts on the iDrive, for example. Personally, I think that's a little weird that you didn't care that much, but, you know, to each their own. And for me, I could not have possibly cared less about reading the manual to fix this problem. I had lived with it for like 6 years at this point. I can live with it some more. However, now that it is fixed, I am quite well, tentatively, I'm quite pleased that I was going to say I spent the time, but really that the internet spent the time to read the PDF for me. So thanks, internet.
Our first sponsor tonight is Fracture. Go to fractureme.com and use code ATP10 to get 10% off your first purchase. Fracture prints photos directly onto glass. Colors pop like you won't believe, and it even comes in a solid backing that's ready to mount right out of the package. All you have to do is stick it on the included screw and hang it up on the wall. Done. It's all really affordable, too. Prices start at just $15 for the small square size and are very reasonable after that. Fracture prints look great. They're all over our house now. They just keep multiplying, and they're everywhere. We've given them as gifts. People love these things. They compliment them. They look great. It is literally a photo printed on a piece of glass, and you stick it on the wall, and that's it. You don't have to frame it. You don't have to worry about it, like, you know, falling off of some little weird hanger thing. It just works, and they're great. They're big. They're beautiful. They're lightweight. You know, again, no stress involved in hanging this thing on the wall. The packaging has been wonderful. We've never received one that was cracked or broken or anything. And, you know, you'd think sending a big piece of glass through the mail, it'd be risky. But no, they have that covered too. It is great. They make great gifts. They're great for yourself. Get your photos printed. Get them out of your, like, weird Facebook and Instagram feeds where you see them for like a day and then they're gone forever. You know, bring them out. Put them on your wall. It really makes a difference. They make fantastic gifts for family, friends, and loved ones as well. You can celebrate a shared memory with somebody if you go, like, you know, go on a trip with somebody, or you, like, your kid has a birthday or whatever. Take pictures, send them to your relatives, or send them to the people who were on the trip with you. Each Fracture is hand-assembled and checked for quality by their small team in Gainesville, Florida. And if you need any more reasons to buy one, besides them being our sponsors, get 10% off right now with the code ATP10. Go to fractureme.com to see for yourself. Thanks a lot to Fracture.
So this past weekend, we celebrated my mother-in-law's birthday, and we had gotten her a Fracture print of a photo that I had taken of Declan at a park nearby that we really like, that she had commented to me, oh, man, that's a really great picture. I really like it, you know, yada, yada, yada. And that was like a month ago. And so we had pretty much instantly turned around, went to Fracture, knowing her birthday was coming, and had that printed, made, pressed, however you want to phrase it. And she opened it up and instantly burst into tears because she was so overjoyed about how good it looked and how awesome it was. And so, seriously, kids, give it a shot. It's really good stuff.
So I actually have some surprise follow-up.
Oh, I thought we were done.
Nope, this is surprise follow-up because on my desk right now, I have two of the Apple Smart battery cases.
Oh, God. Seriously?
Seriously.
We're back to this?
We are going to spend even more time on the Apple Smart battery case. Just quick.
You get one for the Plus and one for regular?
They don't make it for the Plus. No, one for me, one for Tiff.
They only make it in the one size just for the 6S? That's it?
Yeah. Yeah, because The Plus already has enough battery life. Anyway, I have my, you know, my cheap Amazon one that I got, and I expressed some concern about, you know, being not MFI certified. I'm a little worried about what it might do to my phone, but otherwise it seems all right. But I decided for this trip, Tiff wanted one too, and I decided, let's try these. I'll give it a real shot, a real honest shot. And honestly, it's pretty good.
I feel like this is a common theme with you. Ah, oh, this is crap. Fast forward. Ah, you know, that's not so bad.
Yeah, you're right. Nobody else would ever do that, Casey. Like Apple and BMWs and iPhone.
Well, no, I'm not innocent on this one. I'm not innocent. I'm just bringing you down to my level.
I understand the appeal of this case now. You know, so first of all, it is really easy to take on and off because of the weird bendy top. It does indeed look really stupid. Holding it is actually not bad because the little ledge from the bottom edge of the bump, you actually can rest that on your pinky and have kind of a nice handhold there.
Unless you're John.
Unless you're John. But if you hold your phone normally, you can do that. And the smartness aspect of it is really nice, where you never have to turn it on or off. Like that, to me, that is what really sets it apart above all the other ones, is that it is always just automatic. And you can see its status in your today view and in the batteries widget. So, and when you first plug it in, it shows both side by side. It shows the case and your battery. So overall, it's actually pretty nice. It still looks stupid. It's still big and clunky. Not as big and clunky as some battery cases I've seen and used, but it's still big and clunky. The only major downside to it, besides its stupid looks, I think, now having used it, really the only major downside is that the amount of extra capacity that you get really isn't that great. It's something, I mean, I don't know, something like two-thirds of a charge or half a charge. So it is enough if you need just a little boost. But I feel like on the flight on the way out there, we both drained our cases down to nothing and drained our phones down partially, just like in the airports here and there, you know, going in and out of planes and everything. And yes, you can plug it on the plane, but then you have this cable running across your lap and it's kind of inconvenient and you got to reach in the bag in and out. So like ideally you don't have to. So, you know, ultimately they did provide enough power, but it would be nice if they provided more. It's like, if you're going to have the big battery backpack on your phone at all, I would like a little more power than what this offers. Other than that, pretty good. I wouldn't say it's a great value for the money, but because they're $100 and you can get other battery cases for like 50. So, you know, not a great value, but the fact that you never have to turn it on or off and it just automatically charges your phone as necessary and it depletes itself first and charges you first, all those things actually pretty nice. So that's my abbreviated review of the Apple Smart Battery Case after having mercilessly made fun of it for like 3 episodes.
Did you get a white one?
We got one of each color. Tiff insisted on the white. I insisted on the gray. Both colors are crappy colors. The white hasn't discolored itself yet, but I'm sure it will soon. They both pick up tons of pocket lint because they are the rubbery silicone material. Physical form-wise, they are exactly as mediocre as you expect. But they do work pretty well. I would just only wish for a little bit more power. Overall, though, you know, it is not terrible. I expected it to be terrible, and it's not terrible.
Cool. Well, that's surprising, but I guess exciting. Yeah, I mean, the one I have this battery case. I think it's by Lenmar. And yeah, I mean, it's okay. It's a little bit clunky, but I think they have a newer one actually now that's thinner. This one I got with my 6. I like it. It works fine, but it's definitely big and large and I don't know if I'd say heavy, but certainly not light. So it's all right. And I don't know, maybe if I were to do it again, maybe I'd get one of these like you have. To be honest, I did get one of those battery packs that you had recommended. Who makes that again?
Volt Ready.
Volt Ready. That's right. It's got to be reliable. How could it not be?
Yeah. $25 from a company you've never heard of that has all these little flimsy cables on it. It works most of the time.
Why not?
It works exactly what you'd expect for a $25 battery.
That's fair. And I got one of those on your recommendation, which I guess was on someone else's recommendation first. The one I got is a truly hideous gold color because that was the only one that was available at the time. I don't even see it on Amazon anymore, so maybe that's been updated since then. But
it's too tacky even for Amazon.
Seriously. So yeah, so I haven't traveled with it yet, but I am going on a trip soon with a plethora of other people, and I presume it will be a mixed crowd of iPhones and Android phones, and it was appealing to me that this would have a connection for each, because I'm a nice guy like that, so we'll see how it goes. If my phone melts, then you can laugh at me and say I should have gotten the smart battery case.
I'm not sure I would ever tell somebody they should have gotten the smart battery case. Like, it's not that good, and it is fairly expensive. You know, again, it's expensive for the capacity that you get. But, again, it is really nice not to have to manage it, like flip it on and flip it off. Like, that part is really nice.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, this might be just convincing me that I should probably just go with the 7 Plus when the 7 comes out, but we'll see what happens.
Oh, don't do it, man.
Mike might have been right.
Don't do it, man.
Now, you know, well, what's pushing me more and more towards that as time goes on, not only my battery preferences, but also I really don't use iPads. When I at least didn't get myself a Pro, and I'm probably not going to get myself the new, you know, Pro Mini, whatever the heck they're going to call the new iPad Air with pencil support and Pro speakers and Pro like style, like, you know, whatever. The rumors from Gurman is that they're going to call it iPad Pro also. Which my theory on that actually, now that we're talking about it, my theory on that is, I think it makes sense for Apple's current marketing goals to name all the big iPads Pro, because they want people to be thinking of the iPad as a machine that you can do professional work on, to help differentiate it not only from, you know, big phones and everything, but also to help differentiate it from Amazon's like six pack of cheap tablets. You know, like they want the iPad to be a premium product that you can do pro work on if you need or want to. So I think that's, I think that their goal here, if they do indeed call it a Pro of some form, I think their goal here is for you to just think of the iPads as the Pro tablets. And yeah, they'll still have the Mini that probably won't be called Pro, but you know.
So the only non-Pro iPad left will be the Mini? Do they still call that one Mini? There's no more just plain old iPad?
Maybe. I mean, for some of the years that MacBook has existed, there was no just plain old MacBook. And if you look at the laptop lineup, which I think is a fair comparison here, like this was covered pretty well on Upgrade and Connected the last couple of weeks. But if you look at like the Mac lineup, you have some on the low end, and then you have like the entire middle and high end is all called Pro, right? And that's partially because, you know, these are higher end things. Partially because I think Apple realizes like these are, that gives the whole line like an air of professionalism, of premiumness, you know, superiority. And it kind of makes MacBook, you know, you just follow it with Pro. Like that, it kind of makes the whole line seem prestigious to have so many of them called Pro, especially so many of them people actually buy. So you know, to have most of the iPads that end up being sold have Pro in their name, I think helps contribute to the perception Apple wants to create that the iPad can be used for Pro use. Whether or not it can is a different story. That's, you know, many people can, many people can't. Not going to get into that on this episode. But I feel like that is a plausible reason why they would want to do this.
I was on one of those episodes of Upgrade. And what I said on that episode was, I think that the middle size, like the plain iPad size, the original iPad size, I guess you would call it, I think there's room to have a model that's that big with Pro in the name and a model that's also that big without Pro in the name. Because at this point, there are enough Pro features, the smart connector, the pen, the high refresh rate screen, the speakers, that it's enough to differentiate it to say the Pro one has all that stuff and is more expensive. And the non-Pro one that is the same size is thinner, lighter, smaller, cheaper, and worse in all those other ways. Doesn't have a smart connector, doesn't support the pen at all. Maybe the camera's crappier. Maybe it has even the last year's CPU or whatever. But it just seems silly to me to require what I consider the regular iPad size to be encumbered by all of the Pro features. I mean, if I just think about what kind of iPads do rich people want to buy for their toddlers, they don't want to buy them the Pro. But Mini is not, you know, it's more fun for a toddler to have the big screen to like finger paint on and play little games and just do stuff like that. So I really hope eventually, maybe for this first one they won't do it, but I really hope eventually there is a Pro 9.7 inch one. That's the regular size, right?
Yes.
9.7 inch, yeah. There's a Pro 9.7 and a non-Pro 9.7, because already, I mean, there aren't even that many Pro features, but I think there are already enough features to clearly differentiate the two lines, that there wouldn't be any confusion about it. And they can hit more price points. They could push the Pro one up in price, and they could push the non-Pro one down by using cheaper stuff.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. We'll see. You know, knowing Tim Cook's Apple, there's probably going to be like 17 different iPads.
Goodness. All right. So do we want to actually get to what we were planning on talking about today?
Our next sponsor is Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Now, I'll let you in on a little secret. I don't like building websites. I really don't. I really, to me, like building a website for whatever else I'm doing is like the last thing that's on my priority list, the last thing I want to work on. And I just don't enjoy any part of making a website anymore, if I ever did. But I sure don't now. And I'm a web developer. I said I hate making websites. With Squarespace, the great thing about it is that you, for most of the things that you need a website for, you can just make it on Squarespace and then just forget about it. You're done. That's it. Like, you can just move on. So if you need to make a website for a blog, a podcast, you know, a portfolio, a store, there's so many things that you can do on Squarespace with all their built-in tools that you previously would have had to write yourself or use a much more complicated CMS and hosting setup. And with Squarespace, you can just use their online tools. They're simple, they're easy, they're, you know, what you see is what you get, customizable, they come with great designs, stock, you don't have to do anything to them, or you can customize them if you want. You can do all this with Squarespace, and then you can just be done, you can move on with your life. And to me, anything that prevents me from having to make or maintain a website, I consider that very valuable, because the reality is, if you love writing your own CMS, fine. This, it probably isn't the best use of your time for all your projects, but you know, you can probably find a reason to use Squarespace. For everybody else, you can definitely find a reason to use Squarespace, because any website you ever need to make for anything, whether it's for yourself or if you're making a site for somebody else and you don't want to have to support it all the time, do it on Squarespace. Then Squarespace supports it for you. Those people who you're making it for go to Squarespace for help, not you. So check it out today. Go to squarespace.com, start a free trial site right now. When you decide to sign up, make sure to use the offer code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Thank you very much to Squarespace for sponsoring our show.
All right. So there was a bit of a brouhaha over the last week or two about an OS X ransomware attack. This is the one that was in the transmission, which was is a BitTorrent client, and
no, it's a client for acquiring new home videos, home movies. What does the Apple TV call them? Home videos or home movies?
Yeah, home videos, I think they're called.
So yeah, so transmission is a BitTorrent client / home movie acquirer, and apparently, if I understood what happened correctly, the website had been screwed with, hijacked, etc., and somebody re-signed transmission with a valid Apple cert, although not the original transmission cert, I believe, that also had ransomware stuffed within it. And so a bunch of people downloaded from the website and got an infected version of transmission. Now, Sparkle, which is the auto updater that many, many, many apps outside of the App Store use, that I believe was written by Andy Matushak originally. Anyway, that I guess was not affected, but downloads from the website were. And there was a ransomware virus thing in there that basically said, hey, we've encrypted your entire hard drive, pay us money, or you can never get any of your files back.
I thought it encrypted like individual files, not the whole drive. Like it's not whole disk encryption. It would just like find your files and encrypt them.
Yeah, you are correct. So this was a bit of an issue, and the biggest issue is it was signed. I mean, it was a valid Mac app, not for the App Store, of course, but it was a valid Mac app as far as your installation of OS X was concerned, because it was signed with a valid development certificate. Shady, perhaps, because it was coming from a very different place than the normal transmission cert, geographically speaking, but it was still a valid cert, so it was a bit of a cluster, to say the least. What do we think about this?
Well, the big angle that a lot of people started going for was, hey, if this was on the Mac App Store, this would never have happened. And that maybe is true, because what you're relying on the App Store is, I guess, App Review to realize that this supposed BitTorrent client, if you wait a couple of days and it starts encrypting your files, maybe they wouldn't have noticed that, because, again, it does wait a couple of days. Maybe they're trying to wait out App Review. Like, if the App Reviewer launched this app and tried using it, it would work as expected. Does App Review, like, leave it on the system running for a couple of days or leave it around? Like, maybe it would have got past App Review as well. But that's one angle on it. The other one is that the developer ID signing thing, that Apple has created with Gatekeeper means that you download applications and they come in three forms. Totally unsigned, you know, pre-Gatekeeper applications, which is how every single Mac app was in all the years before Gatekeeper was created. applications that are signed with a developer ID but don't come from the Mac App Store, and then Mac App Store applications. And that's sort of like three levels of, I guess, trust. The totally untrusted one doesn't require any signature. You download a binary, you run it, it runs. And that's, you know, that's the way Mac apps were for most of the life of the Mac. The developer ID ones, all that does is tie it back to an Apple developer account, which presumably ties back to a person or institution or somebody that you can hold responsible or whatever. That's kind of relying on Apple's sign-up process to correctly identify somebody. So, like, can you go through, can you get an Apple developer certificate putting in totally fake information? Probably. But that's the only thing that developer ID is giving you, that, well, two things. One, that your application hasn't been modified in any way, which is kind of weird. He's like, well, wasn't transmission modified? Well, they didn't just modify it, they re-signed it. So after they modified, they signed it with their developer certificate, and that certificate authenticated the fact that, yes, this thing, if someone modifies this thing after you download it, you'll know about it because the signature won't match. But what you're worried about is someone modified it and then signed it, and it is you know, a valid container for their malware. So if anyone tried to mess with their malware, signing would have caught it. And then the Mac App Store, like, it's the next leg up where there's actual human beings looking at your application and making sure it's okay. So why wasn't this application on the Mac App Store? My understanding is the Mac App Store does not allow BitTorrent clients at all. Do you guys know if that's the case?
That's right.
I believe that to be true. And a quick real-time follow-up, this encryption would never have worked due to sandboxing. So even if it made it through app review, it wouldn't have been able to touch the rest of the...
Oh, because it can't get through, can't get the other files.
Well, I mean, in reality, like, this is a BitTorrent client. So it needs to be able to write torrent downloads to a directory. And so what would probably happen is, yes, you could use sandboxing to, you know, have it pop up the dialog and have you choose the directory where it can write. Much more likely it would be that even if it was sandboxed outside of the Mac App Store, even if it was sandboxed, there would probably just be some option where they're like, all right, well, just, you know, we need to write your whole drive to make some feature easier or to make this flow better. And most people would say, okay.
You can't even get that. You can't even get that, what do you call it, entitlement anymore, I think.
I think you're right. Well, so then it just wouldn't be sandboxed and nobody would care. You know, like, the, so, yeah, I mean, what would make it useful in the App Store is the sandboxing requirement of the App Store, which is problematic in so many other ways. But in this particular case, that would have helped. However, the reality is, as long as there is a way to download apps that aren't in the App Store on the Mac, something like a BitTorrent client is almost certainly going to be downloaded outside of the App Store by almost all of its users, just because dealing with the App Store kind of sucks, even as a user these days. And you can make a better BitTorrent app without sandboxing.
So where the developer ID thing really came in here is, like, this transmission could have been the third kind of application that I said, not signed with any stuff, it's just a binary that you download, it's sort of an old-style Mac app. And if that had been the case, and tons of people had downloaded it, and it started encrypting their drives, there would be no real way to help them other than education, saying, hey, if you accidentally downloaded this from this website during this time, you probably got an infected version, you should delete it and do this and do that, and here's how to disinfect your system, and so on and so forth. But because it was signed with a developer ID, Apple could revoke the certificate of that developer ID through the little sneaky update thing that we just described, the checkbox that we didn't think was there. The reason regular users should keep that checkbox checked is that Apple has central control to make it so this thing doesn't launch anymore.
We actually are getting real-time follow-up from Tipster in the chat saying that Apple can blacklist any binary through that system, including unsigned ones.
Oh, well, then developer ID wasn't helping at all. That's a shame.
Yeah.
So what were the makers of Transmission getting out of using developer ID? I suppose they make people not have to go to their gatekeeper settings and put it in the most insecure mode.
Well, no, you can also, what is it, right-click and go and select open, and then it'll say, oh my God, are you really sure? And then you can say, yes, I'm really sure.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. What do you get out of the developer ID thing as a developer? I guess you get less scary experience for users because you don't require them to go to a setting that they don't understand and change it in a way that pops up a warning dialog boxes or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like you don't require them to, like, right click and select open the first time they run the app and then go through the extra scary. Like, they still have the scary, this is an application you downloaded from the internet dialog, but if they just double click on an app under default settings that is unsigned, it doesn't let them run it. it says, oh, sorry, this is unsigned. And then you have to like right click and say open. Then so it lets them bypass all of that, which, you know, if you're distributing Mac apps in this day and age, you should almost always have at least developer ID, if not the App Store.
And of course, in theory, you can track it back to whoever, whatever Apple developer account signed the bad piece of, you know, and again, that just gets back to detective work. Can you find someone who you want to hold responsible? Do they put valid information? Are they in a country that has a legal system that lets you find them or hold them accountable in some way? I'm assuming not. I mean, the other alternative suggested in the chat room is that maybe it was just a legitimate developer. They got a developer account hacked. Someone got into their developer account. Either by getting their password, doing some other way to get into their developer account. There's also been a couple of bugs around that make it seem like you could exploit Gatekeeper to execute arbitrary software as if it's trusted. Those have been surmised in years past. But there's so many ways you can hide from the consequences of doing this bad thing. That's like the maker of this ransomware, like they're a bad actor here. Are they going to be caught and punished? Do we have the tools to do that? Maybe. Maybe not. Probably not. I mean, not everyone is somewhere where you can get at them. So anyway, XProtect, the thing that downloads the little updates in the background and disables things.
Like your Ethernet driver.
Yeah, it may have. It may have disabled your Ethernet driver 1 week, but the next week it may have saved you from getting your files encrypted by ransomware.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those cases where most of the time, one of the angles that like big business tries to scare people with to scare them away from piracy is, well, you know, if you pirate stuff, you never know what you're getting. It could be dangerous. You could get hacked. You could get malware. You know, and most of the time, that doesn't happen with piracy. Like, most of the time, it's fine. And that's one of the reasons so many people do it. But this is like the one time where they were actually right. Like, this, where, you know, this, you really need protections from Gatekeeper and from sandboxing. And you shouldn't pirate things because you're putting yourself at risk downloading random software from random places. Like, this is the one time where that was actually true. But that being said, I think this made for interesting news, and it could prompt some interesting discussions for these few days, but I don't think this is going to meaningfully change anything for anybody. It's estimated that, I think somebody said that the total number of downloads with the malware included was only something like 6,000, which for something like this, that's not that giant of a number. And then, you know, Apple fairly quickly blacklisted the binary, so it probably didn't even trigger the malware, like the encryption step of the malware, for most of those people. So this doesn't seem like it's that big of an event. It's more about, you know, how we're all talking about, like, you know, does this change our opinions of what the Mac should be, where it should go, security on the Mac, and that I think is a conversation worth having. But this particular malware, I think, is mostly a non-event.
And interestingly, it wasn't like pirated software that was infected. It was the software you used to get the pirated software.
Right, exactly.
Which is slightly different, but...
And home movies, and don't forget.
Yeah, and this is kind of a shame because developers like this, whose applications basically can't be on the Mac App Store for a policy reason, setting aside all the things that you talked about, Marco, about like, well, the good ones would want full access to your drive and it's less annoying to use. But even just like if they're categorically denied, because we think BitTorrent clients are just as a category, a thing that we don't want on the Mac App Store for whatever reason. If you're a developer who makes a BitTorrent client and you're trying to like do as good a job as you can do not being in the Mac App Store, you would get a developer ID and you would sign your application and you would do all these things. But you know, everyone gets boarded sometimes. You could end up getting hacked. They could hack your website. They could shove a little thing inside your downloadable application bundle and your reputation is smeared because everyone, you know, thinks that whether you knew about it or not, it's like, oh, transmission, isn't it that thing that encrypts your drive? And you know, like, I feel like they're doing everything they could within the bounds of the technology and the, you know, the sort of the rules of the system they're operating in. And I feel bad that they had a bad result from that. Because I don't blame the developers. And I do give credit to Apple for having the, putting in the system that they put in so many years ago to give them the ability to deal with this. But it does make me feel a little bit less safe about downloading applications on the Mac, because I downloaded plenty of applications not from the Mac App Store, or from the Mac App Store for that matter, and every single one of those is exploitable through a non-technological means. Like, for example, Mac App Store application, I don't have any faith that AppReview would correctly detect some sort of clever sleeping, you know, it waits a week and then it wakes up and does something bad to your thing. And all that it takes for that to happen is for someone to get some poor legitimate developer's developer account password and, you know, muck up one of their builds or submit a build while they're away on vacation or do something else. Like, that's just like a social engineering hack. It's nothing to do with technology. As far as the entire tech stack is concerned, this would be a completely validated, approved Mac application. And there would be sandbox and everything like that. And I have, you know, is there a way to get out of the sandbox? Within the bounds of the sandbox, can you do all sorts of damage? Probably. Like, you could turn on the camera. You could capture keystrokes typed into that application. Who knows what you could do? So, like, there is no truly safe scenario. And I wonder exactly how much safer users are overall if applications, if we assume that the Mac App Store is a superior level of security to just developer ID, it seems to me that every category of application that is just not allowed on the Mac App Store for some reason is potentially decreasing the security of users over what they could be if the Mac App Store was more permissive in terms of, sure, you can have a BitTorrent client. Like, it's, you know, we don't say those things are, you know, no matter what, we don't say those things are just evil. We don't care how you use them, because there are legitimate uses for them. There's plenty of Linux distros and stuff that are distributed via BitTorrent because it's a fast way to download stuff. Anyway, software is dangerous. Be careful out there.
No, man, this is like, that's the argument, one of the strongest arguments for Apple to actually improve the Mac App Store and sandboxing. Because right now they have a situation where the Mac App Store is just beyond disrepair. I mean, it's seemingly totally unstaffed. There's the app itself that is the, you know, the store app that runs is horrible. It's buggy, it's messy, it's inconsistent, it's outdated. I mean, it's just, I'd say it's one of the worst apps Apple ships right now, is the Mac App Store app. The service behind it is spotty at best. Review times for developers are lengthy and inconsistent, way worse than iOS. And you have this technical requirement of sandboxing that, while great in theory, is a huge pain for developers because it has also been kind of half-baked in its implementation and also effectively unmaintained. So, you know, and I want to maybe get to Steve Troughton Smith's post about his WWDC predictions that came up a couple weeks ago, and his statement that Mac OS X is a dead platform. I want to maybe get to that, but maybe this might lead us into that a little bit. But it just seems like, you know, Apple started down this path with the App Store and sandboxing. They said, all right, here's the future. Here's how we're going to do this. This is going to be great. They started, and then it seems like nothing has changed since the Mac App Store launched, except the introduction of sandboxing, which came shortly after that. And then it seems like nothing has changed with sandboxing since then either. So we have the situation now where we have what is in theory a great system that could in theory protect people's Macs better and have more secure software and have easier distribution. But in practice, the implementation of that system has been fairly mediocre, and it's been almost untouched for years. So if Apple really wants to improve the security of the Mac, what they have to do is make these things better. Make the App Store and sandboxing able to support more apps so that more apps can do it, and make them good enough that the developers are incentivized. They actually want to be in the App Store, and they actually want to adopt sandboxing. But it just seems like there's like nobody, you know, driving the ship or whatever.
If you had been looking at the show notes, you would have seen we pushed that down for next week. And if you had not been on vacation, you would have heard me talk about that exact question on Upgrade. Jason stole that one, but I did.
Oh, spoiler alert. I haven't listened yet. I was saving it for my car ride coming up tomorrow.
All right. But I did reject one of the topics that Jason suggested because I wanted to save it for this show.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
And it was not that one.
No, I mean, I think there's some ground to cover here that you guys didn't cover on Upgrade. Because, you know, you made a good case for what the Mac is and what it should be, which I can summarize if you'll permit, is basically like the Mac should be like the rock, like the stable, reliable platform that's kind of boring, doesn't get a lot of updates, but is stable and reliable. And I agree.
That was one option. The other option was you do another OS X type transition.
Right, sure. Honestly, though, I don't really see Apple doing that. I mean, I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But it doesn't seem like they devote enough resources to the Mac anymore to really do any more big transitions. I think the era of big Mac transitions is over. And that might be good. It's probably not. But ultimately, it seems like modern-day Apple seems to have this severe problem of basically just, like, as I mentioned before, like the kind of the drive-by updates, because they don't really have enough people that are like permanently staffed on major parts of their engineering stuff anymore. Like, it seems like so much of Apple's engineering resources are being devoted to other things. iOS, TV, watch, a car, most likely, you know, other things like that. It seems like they keep moving the talent around so much that there's just nobody left working on boring old things like the Mac. And we haven't even seen how they can do their current platforms yet. Like, we haven't even seen what happens with watchOS and tvOS this year. They're each, you know, less than a year old. What, you know, does Apple have the engineering capacity to keep macOS, iOS on the iPhone and the iPad, which are actually quite different these days, tvOS, watchOS, and a future carOS? Do they have the capacity to maintain all of those to a healthy level? From what we've seen so far, I think the answer is probably not. So the question is, like, you know, what gets backburnered? What gets put in Casey's parking lot full of white cars? What gets ignored? You know, and I think usually it's been the Mac and the iPad. That's usually what gets ignored. This year, you know, the iPad got some attention. We'll see what happens as time goes on. But they probably are not in the position where they're going to devote tons of engineering talent to the Mac. And that's unfortunate. And it is a mature platform that doesn't need a lot of attention. But I'm concerned whether they'll be able to do any kind of big changes in the future. So I think it's more likely that we will keep it on its current path of basically being the nice, boring thing that most of us use and depend on very heavily for our work. But it doesn't really get a lot of attention from Apple.
I don't know if it's so much about their capacity to do it as, like, that they're going to put resources towards things with growth potential. And regardless of the size of the Mac and how it may be growing, I think the company feels that the potential growth that does not warrant putting lots of resources behind it. Versus, say, the watch, where it's conceivable that they could believe that the watch is like the start of a whole wearables thing, and that the potential upside is huge. So we're going to put lots of time and effort into the watch, and then we'll see if the growth potential is there. But the Mac, I think the company feels like, and most customers and observers of the industry feel like, there is not a tremendous growth potential in traditional personal computers anymore. So when it comes time to allocate Apple's billions of dollars, it's easier to make the argument for the car or the watch or even the TV, because they're all so small or so new or so non-existent that it's very easy to spin out a tale of potential huge growth, that we will start down here and the graph will go way up there. Whereas the Mac, if it has to argue for its resources, it can show what its revenue is and how it's growing faster than the industry and how it's taking share from Windows PCs. But if they say, okay, is the Mac going to be four times the size it is in a couple of years? They have to say, well, no, probably not. And so maybe they just don't get the resources.
Hold on. Before we go too far deeper on this, because I think this might take a while, let's cover our final sponsor.
Us? Take a while on something about Apple and the Mac?
Right.
Our final sponsor this week is Hover. Go to hover.com for the best way to buy and manage domain names. Use promo code this week, Craig's House, for 10% off your first purchase. Hover gives you easy-to-use, powerful tools to buy and manage domain names, so anybody can do it. Whether it's geeks like us or regular people, Hover is easy to use, and they have great support if you need it. In fact, they even have amazing phone support, where if you are confused or need them to do something, you can call them on the phone during business hours, and they have a no-wait, no-hold, no-transfer phone policy, which means that literally you call them on the phone, and if it's business hours, a human being picks up the phone, And that human being can help you. They don't have to transfer you to five different things. There's no stupid menus. You don't have to say, like, track a package. Like, none of that crap. It's just straightforward. A human being picks up the phone who can help you. It's fantastic. And, of course, they also have, you know, email support if you need that, and online resources, stuff like that. But Hover is great. In less than 5 minutes, you can find a domain name that you want, and you can get it up and running. All you have to do is search for a few keywords, and they will show you the best available options across all the domain extensions out there. And there are so many weird domains now. You can get, like, .diamonds and .plumbing and everything. They have all those, plus all the old ones. You can get a more conservative name if you want to. But basically, with all these new TLDs out there, almost any word you want, you can get dot something with that word in front of it. So it's great. Now, and if you ever use any other domain registrars before, you probably know that it's been unpleasant in the past to register domain names. Most of these sites, they're clunky, they're hard to use. They might try to railroad you into like confusing upsells or weird privacy options that you don't really understand. Hover doesn't believe any of that. They have great designs. They're respectful of you and your time and your attention and your money. Because Hover does not try to upsell you on crazy stuff. They include everything for free that should be free, like domain privacy. And they really have very reasonably priced options after that for things like email hosting. If you need email in your domain, that's really easy to get, really simple. But you don't have to. You can just get the domain and be done with it. Very reasonable prices. Overall, they're really simple to use, and they're very respectful of you. And those are things that are pretty rare in this business. Go to hover.com and use promo code CraigsHouse for 10% off your first purchase. Thanks a lot to Hover for sponsoring our show. So I think with the Mac, what's important about it is that they just maintain what they've started here. You know, the Mac is the pinnacle of personal computing. It really is the best personal computer out there. And whether or not personal computing has a huge growth potential in front of it, I think you're right, it probably doesn't. But that doesn't mean it's going away, and that doesn't mean it isn't already big and important. You know, and yeah, it isn't as important as the iPhone, but it is still really important to a lot of people. And it is also the area in which I would say Apple has the worst and least threatening competition. You know, that Apple has tons of competition, you know, very strong competition in phones, in tablets, in watches, in TV boxes, and they will have tons of competition in cars if they're doing that, which sure sounds like they are. In the Mac, for personal computing, I don't know a lot of Mac users who are like, you know what, I'm tempted to go try Windows. Like, that never happens. Like, yeah, they don't have, you know, Windows is still the majority market shareholder, but first of all, that says something about growth, I think. But you know, Windows is still, you know, the majority holder here, but the Mac is so good, and so many of us rely on it, and I feel like it's Apple's responsibility to keep it decent, to keep it good. You know, Apple needs the Mac also. I mean, what are they writing these iOS apps on? I mean, I guess we can get to Xcode on the iPad as a potential future thing, but...
Xcode for iOS is coming.
Is it?
Someday. Remember the Swift announcement? I totally thought that was going to be... I did tweet about it a while back. I pinpointed the exact second in the video when they were leading up to the Swift announcement. They said a couple sentences, and I thought the sentences were like, this is it. It's Xcode for iOS. It wasn't. But the fact that I was so willing to believe that that's what they were announcing based on like their vague introductory statements, it just seems inevitable to me someday. But yeah, like the Mac is not, you talk about the weak competitors to the Mac, like, you know, no one wants a Dell running Windows or whatever. As we all know, the real competitor to the Mac is things that are not personal computers. Apple knows that. Everybody knows that. The maintenance argument is like, all right, well, so until and unless something comes along that can do everything the Mac does better, right? Until the iPad Pro grows into that role or whatever the heck grows into that role. Like maybe we're all into VR by then. Who knows? Until that happens, we still got Macs. It's still a big business. You have to put a certain amount of effort into it just to keep that business going. And that argues for that, like the suggestion you mentioned from Upgrade, my one of two paths for the Mac, which is the stability path, which is not just like do what it takes to keep the Mac sort of humming along the way it is, but like, you know, I basically describe two strengths of the Mac. One strength of the Mac is that it is the platform that you expect not to change and grow that much. Like it's not in the market that's taking off like a rocket ship or whatever. So how can you turn that into a strength? You can turn that into a strength by saying, okay, what we're going to do with the Mac year after year after year, it's all we're going to do is find every single thing that doesn't work on it and make it work. Like that's all we're going to do. We're not going to care how many bullet points or features that we have. Like it doesn't mean like you're not going to add features, But every single release, all you want to do is brag about how much better the thing, you know, how much more it does what it was always supposed to do in the first place, how much more stable it is, you know, how many bugs you squashed, any part of it, you know, security would be a great area to go into on the Mac, because that's kind of a stability thing. It's not like a feature, like we're really nailing down security even more and more, closing more security holes, being, you know, that's one way to go. And so that would make an experience as a Mac user is like, well, every year there's not a million new features, but every year the Mac gets better and better. Like it gets better for the purpose that we're using it. And that would be, and you would sell it based on that. You would say, like, you could start saying the world's most reliable operating system or bulletproof or, you know, whatever, however you want to spin it. Like you can sell stability, because if you told any Mac user right now that we have a new version of the Mac operating system that, you know, Snow Leopard style has no new features, and not only that, but also like we didn't rip out any subsystems and change them or anything. We just like, we said, what it does now, we're going to make it do that better. People were like, yeah, sure, sign me up. If you heard from friends that, hey, I installed the new Mac operating system and everything was exactly the same except for whatever problem I used to have is gone now, they would love that, right? And the other option to go on the Mac is what is the other strength of the Mac? It's not, you have, I'm not going to say it's not battery powered because laptops are the majority of the Mac sold, but you have a higher power envelope than you do on iPads and phones and stuff like that. You can, right now, you can put more powerful stuff inside a Mac, even a laptop, than you can inside a phone or a tablet, because iPads are because Macs and, you know, even the thinnest laptop Macs and everything, they have a higher overhead. You can fit more stuff in there. You can put a bigger battery and you can put a hotter CPU. Maybe not that much hotter in the case of the MacBook One, but certainly much hotter in the case of the iMac, which is plugged into the wall, or the Mac Pro or the 15-inch or whatever. Take advantage of that. Pursue the high end there. Try to install the fastest of the fast stuff. Cater to the idea that if you have minimal computer needs, get the MacBook One or an iOS device. But if you really want a big, strong Mac, we'll make you the biggest, strongest Mac that you can have. And then what you would do with the software is say, every year is going to get faster and more powerful, and we're going to have, you know, the fanciest features and the best GPUs and the best CPUs and the fastest SSDs and stuff like that. Really make it like a pro product that takes advantage of the Mac. And so far, Apple seems to be doing neither one of those things. Instead, they're kind of like limping along. Every year they feel like they need to do a release where they have some features to tout, and they're kind of monkeying around inside there, and they do fix the bugs. They don't make it super duper fast, and, you know, but they don't, on the other hand, they don't do nothing year after year and make it boring. And that strategy of sort of maintenance level investment with an outward appearance of every year there's an amazing new OS just doesn't seem to be striking a good balance for customers.
One thing I would say too is, like, and Steve Tratton Smith covered this in his blog post also, I really think that development of apps for the Mac is really seemingly at a standstill. You know, even Apple can barely keep their own apps developed for the Mac. And certainly third-party development for the Mac seems to be almost non-existent. I mean, there's just very little action happening there. All the action's on iOS. And obviously a big part of that is that developing apps on iOS has a bigger market. You know, you can sell to more people. There's more people shopping in the App Store, so like the chances of you making a ton of money by being on a top chart is higher on iOS probably. But there is a big part of this too on the Mac, where the Mac does not run UIKit. The Mac runs AppKit, its own, you know, older framework that is kind of like UIKit. But when you write apps for iOS, you're writing against this newer, kind of cleaner, more modern framework. And when you write apps for the Mac, you're writing against this crustier, older framework that has a lot more baggage and legacy in it. UIKit was kind of, for iOS, was kind of like, you know, the new version of the UI framework with all the lessons they've learned from AppKit over the years. And the Mac has gotten some of those lessons ported back to it from iOS for developers to make their lives easier, but I think still not most of them. And I think as a developer who came here kind of through iOS, and I currently am not, I don't have any Mac apps that I've released. Or that I'm working on, really. Don't get crazy. Sorry. So, you know, I would be so much more likely to put effort into Mac apps if they used a version of UIKit. And I've tried AppKit. I've tried making macOS before, and I'm sure if I was you know, entirely motivated to do it, I'd plow through and I'd learn, and it would be fine. I'd learn AppKit. I'd tolerate the inconsistencies, and it would be fine. But the fact is, right now, the fact that I have to learn this similar but still fairly different UI framework on the Mac to make Mac apps, that is a big barrier that is discouraging me from doing it. So you have a combination of no UI kit on the Mac, plus the crappy App Store situation, plus the fact that it's a smaller market to begin with. I feel like something there has to change for developers to be interested in making Mac apps. And right now, it seems like nothing is on the horizon for any of those two things to change. You know, AppKit proponents or experts can make all the same arguments that shouldn't matter that people like me make about Swift not being necessary. Like, you know, you can look at that and you can say, well, you know, I could learn Objective-C, but it has all these ugly brackets. I don't want to. And Swift comes along eventually, and Swift is getting a lot of people into iOS and Mac development who weren't there before because they just didn't want to learn Objective-C. A similar kind of effect could happen on the Mac with UIKit. You know, if they brought UIKit in some form, obviously it couldn't be identical, but if they brought it in some form to the Mac, I think that would really bring in a lot of developer interest and really help reignite third-party interest in the Mac as an application platform.
So I hear us, and we're not the only ones, talk about, well, the Mac App Store is a dumpster fire, which, to be frank, it kind of is. Nobody's doing much for the iPad these days, by and large. Obviously, Federico, amongst others, would disagree. But certainly, there's a lot of people that aren't paying a lot of attention to the iPad. You're not paying much attention to the iPad, Marco, for example. And, oh, pay up front apps are a dumpster fire. Maybe that's a poor way of phrasing it, but they don't really work. The only thing that's even slightly working seems to be free within app purchase. So I feel like the three of us, and again, we're not the only ones, say the Mac App Store sucks. iPad App Store sucks. The iPhone App Store has a lot of great options, but it sucks to make money in. Are we crazy? Like, there's a lot of apps in the App Store, and there's a lot of stuff getting made every single day. So why? Like, either we're a little bit crazy, or it's just not as dire as we think it is. Does that make sense? Like, it just, the situation cannot be as bad as we're painting it.
I think you're confusing different kinds of badness. All right, so one kind of badness is the fact that it doesn't seem to be a lot of people making new Mac applications. Like, there's every week there aren't thousands of new Mac applications, most of which may be crap, but every once in a while there's a good one. Like, there's not a lot of activity, not a lot of churn, not a lot of, like, there's not a growing base of customers to sell to. That base is small, and there's not tons and tons of developers knocking on the door to make tons of new Mac apps. So that's one kind of ailment, because if you have a software market and not many people are making new applications for that platform, the platform feels kind of crappy. The iPhone has the opposite problem. Everybody wants to make an app. Everybody's making an app, and they're just all climbing all over each other to get the last scraps and figuring out how to exploit people, how to extract money from people. There's so many apps. There's too many apps in the App Store. It's not because people don't care about the iPhone. People care about the iPhone a lot. Like, there's tons of developers, there's tons of apps. And all the things you described about there, about how you can't have paid upfront apps and blah, 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 that's a symptom of an entirely opposite problem, which is, you know, too much activity, lots of competition, lots of people trying to figure out how to get money, and plenty of people are getting rich on the App Store, like enough people that it attracts other people, right? From the outside, it looks like all you hear about the stories of the five developers who are getting rich, and you don't realize that there were 10,000 apps submitted that week, right? And none of those people are going to get rich. But there's enough people getting rich that it seems like that's the place to go. Everyone has phones. It's a huge market. Even if that market isn't growing, it's still tremendous. So there's just two ends of the spectrum, the phone and the Mac, both of which have problems, but they're totally opposite problems. I mean, you would kill to get a little bit of that iOS App Store problem on the Mac where, oh, we can't handle the overflow. Every time I look at the Mac App Store, there's 10,000 new applications. I can't handle it. That just doesn't happen, right? So, and then in the middle, the iPad, I think it has more of the Mac's problem where it's like, yeah, there's lots of applications that you can run on the iPad, but not a lot of them really take advantage of what's different about the iPad. You know, so the big complaint now is that people are iOS applications that already run on the iPad but don't take advantage of split screen or don't support the iPad Pro's display or both. And why don't they update them? Well, it turns out that they're, even though the iOS platform has tons of customers, the iPad subset is much smaller. And so it's more like the Mac where you're like, if I have to spend some time, I'm going to make sure that my iOS application is updated for the iPhone 7 or whatever new features that has. And then maybe when I have time, I'll update the, if I get around to it, I'll update my, the iPad version of my iOS application to take advantage of something that only works on the big iPads like split screen or whatever. So you're right that there's something to complain about everywhere, but I don't think it's as if we're saying that they all have the same problem. They have very different problems with very different causes and very different solutions. So it doesn't seem to be a contradiction to me.
I guess that's fair. I don't know. It seems weird that all three platforms seem to have some really, really systemic issues. And I'm not saying that those issues aren't real. I'm not saying that they're not extremely important, but I don't know. It just, how does Apple not care or not fix this, or are we crazy and it's not as bad as we think it is? I don't know. It just seems weird to me that we feel, and again, when it's not just us, so many people feel like this is broken, and there seems to be not a lot of care given to it from Apple. And I presume that there is care, but as usual, it's all happening internally and we're none the wiser. But golly, it seems weird to me that there's no action on this.
Well, you haven't listed like the pros of, for example, the Mac side, where something that we all hear from our developer friends, and is probably true, is that it's easier to make money with a really good application on the Mac than it is on iOS. Because if you have a really good application on iOS, guess what? There are thousands of really good applications on iOS. If you have a really good application on the Mac, there are not thousands of really good applications on the Mac, especially not thousands in your category, whatever kind of application that you made. And for whatever reason, again, it may just have to do with physical size or whatever, you can tend to charge more for the Mac versions. Not tremendously more these days, but still more. So if you are a super talented developer, and you can make a really good application in a category that is not overcrowded on any platform, if you make it a Mac application, charge $9.99 for it, even though you will sell far fewer copies, you will make up for it for the fact that you'll make more money on the Mac. And again, it's hard to go apples to oranges there. It's like, well, you can't make the same application that you can make on iOS. And who knows, maybe it'll take you longer to make it on the Mac because, like Marco, you don't know the Mac and you have to learn it or whatever. There are lots of variables in the mix here. But I would imagine sort of the average price of applications sold on the Mac, the ones that are not free, is higher than on iOS. And Mac users are still willing to pay money for good applications. And your application really will stand out because you don't have to compete with the thousands and thousands of other really talented developers who may have the same idea for an application in the same category as you. And that's, again, it's the opposite type of problem. Like if you look at someone like Omni, who does both things, they have great Mac applications that they charge real money for, not 99 cents. And they also have companion iOS applications. And I think they're finding a way to play to the strengths of each platform. Like, we should make a Mac application because our applications are complicated and sophisticated and we can charge high prices for them and Mac users will pay it. Whereas if we have sophisticated, complicated applications, they either won't work on iOS because it's just not a platform that supports this complexity. And if it does work, we have to charge less money. And on the other hand, people want to have access to their data on the go and so on and so forth. So we'll make a series of iOS applications, which will be high priced for iOS applications, but still lower priced than like a $99 Mac app or whatever. And it'll be a virtuous cycle and you'll be able to use your Mac and your iOS applications together. Like, it is possible to take advantage of the ecosystems as they exist and make money off of it and do a good job. But Omni, I feel like, is kind of grandfathered in that they have the expertise and talent and experience on the Mac platform and have expanded out into iOS. If I think of like, where is the next Omni coming from? Is there going to be a company that starts up now that has that deep expertise on the Mac and is able to make amazing Mac applications and charge reasonable prices for them and also make companion iOS applications? I don't know how many of those are popping up. Whereas on iOS, like I said, since there are so many people, since the numbers are so big, even if a fraction of a percent of them end up striking it rich, it's enough that you. I just saw a story the other day, like some story about the people make Clash of Clans, how many millions and millions of dollars they're making off of that stuff. There's just so much activity and so many customers happening on iOS that it is attracting people. Whereas the Mac, I don't see it attracting people. Even I felt even better in the days of like Textmate, where it's like, what's this? A text editor coming in? I never heard of this Textmate text editor. How dare he try to make a text editor? Everyone knows the text editor market is all sewn up by insert name of other competitors here. But Textmate was very popular and it could have been a going concern if if the Mac market had been enough to, you know, make the maker of TextMate as much money as Clash of Clans got, you can be sure he'd still be making that, and Marco wouldn't be using TextMate 2 or whatever old version he's using now.
He is still making it. 2 is in beta with constant updates.
I know, it's the open source thing.
Welcome to the end of Build and Analyze, like 5 years ago or whatever that was.
Yeah, I know. But you know, not that text editors are an exciting field, but like text editing is something that people do on the Mac. And it's not as if there are 17 really good, high-quality text editors that come out for the Mac every week. There's maybe like one or two a year, right? And they usually have to have an iOS counterpart or no one's interested in them.
So another thing I've been thinking about a lot lately is, am I an old man? And bear with me here. But I think it is really silly, the hoops that someone like Federico jumps through. And I have deep respect for Federico, but it seems silly to me, the hoops that Federico jumps through in order to accomplish things that are really quite simple on the Mac. And we talked about this a few weeks ago when I was talking about signing a PDF from my iPad and dealing with scans and things like that, and how for me it was very, very difficult to do that. And I talked with a handful of people like Mike Hurley about that segment because Mike used to be very anti-iPad and then now is like almost as big an iPad fan as Federico is. And I don't know, it just seems to me like they feel like I'm missing the point. And in Federico's case, it is deeply important to him to be able to work from anywhere. And that's semi-true with the Mac-ish, or, you know, maybe it's true with a Mac and a tethered phone, but it's not as true as an iPad Pro. You know, you can take an iPad Pro anywhere, it has its own internet connection, and you can work anywhere. And it still seems to me to be a bit crazy. And I can't help but wonder, are the three of us just too old to understand the purpose of the iPad? And to bring this back to what Steven was saying on his post, is OS X really kind of dead? Like, I don't know. It just seems like maybe we're the ones that are missing the boat.
What do you mean? We need to lump me in with you. I'm the one who wanted an iPad Pro. I'm the actual iPad user. I have one sitting next to my bed.
Well, I use my iPad daily, so I am also a very frequent iPad user. I love my iPad. I love it, but I would never in a million years look to my iPad to get something done over looking at my Mac. Even to some degree, the typical things like consumption. Maybe if I'm just cruising Twitter, I would probably choose my iPad over my Mac, but damn near anything else, man, I'm going to go to my Mac first because I just feel faster, quicker, better with it. And I guess what I'm saying in a roundabout way is that because it's what I'm used to? And it's not that the Mac is faster and quicker and better. Sure, empirically it is. But you know what I mean? Like, is it just because that's what I'm used to and I have severely OS X colored glasses?
Let me settle this for you. We are all old men. I am, in this way, the oldest. I am the least flexible, you know, most skeptical of new things, most defensive of my old ways of the three of us. I also like the iPad the least out of the three of us, I think. That being said, I have no problem with people who can do tons of their work or all their work on the iPad.
Oh, sure.
I could, honestly, because there's a number of advantages to going all iPad. You know, obviously, there's the physical advantages that iPads are smaller and lighter and have better battery life usually than most Mac laptops. But also, you know, that's kind of where Apple's attention is. Now, again, that being said, I wouldn't necessarily assume that the iPad version of iOS is going to keep Apple's attention for very long. It has it now, but it didn't have much attention for years. And as we see Apple getting pulled in all these different directions as they try to tackle everything all at once with limited engineering resources and a few ways that they're unwilling to budge that will make it hard for them to attract more engineering talent to get as much as they need. Things like, you know, remote workers, salaries, terms of employment, stuff like that, that just make it hard for them to attract certain talent. It's only a matter of time before the iPad falls out of the spotlight for Apple. Like it's only a matter of time before the resources that were devoted to making iOS 9 really great on the iPad and getting the iPad Pro out the door and getting the multitasking and stuff like that, like, you know, getting like the special things for the iPad that are in iOS. It's only a matter of time before those resources are put somewhere else, before that attention is directed somewhere else in Apple. So I don't necessarily expect the iPad to be Apple's star platform for long. But right this second, it is. So right this second, if you are a person who gets all your work done or a lot of your work done on an iPad, this is a great time to be one of those people because you're getting cool new stuff from Apple, you know, recently, and seemingly you might get a little bit more soon, right? Who knows? We'll see what iOS 10 does. But it's kind of nice to be like in Apple's sweet spot of like where they're putting their attention, where they're putting, you know, their resources, and what they're likely to do in the future, right? So that's nice. But I don't. To me, it just doesn't stick, right? The iPad, it to me, it does feel like jumping through tons of hoops. But that's just the work I do, and it's the kind of use that I do. It's the kind of user I am. It's what I'm used to. You know, I think personal computers with, you know, keyboard, mouse, big monitor, at a desk a lot of the time, I think that world is going to stay for a long time. I don't think it is as dire as a lot of people have said. But I also, I totally don't begrudge anybody else for using whatever they think is better and whatever they're most comfortable with. Because for them, it's iPads and phones, maybe. For me, it's Macs. And that's fine, you know? And the only problem is that it is pulling Apple in all these different directions. It is pulling their resources in all these different directions. And I think that could be a bit of a problem. And we've seen it become a little bit of a problem so far with just like things that get ignored and things that get neglected and things that get these drive-by updates. I hope they can find a way to resolve this, but I'm not hopeful about the chance of that actually happening. I don't know. I really hope I'm wrong about all this and that, you know, that over the next couple of years they prove us wrong and we see major significant changes to the app stores and, you know, macOS gets notable updates and they keep updating all their new product lines and not just neglect the ones that aren't getting them a lot of attention forever. But I don't see any evidence that we're heading in that kind of direction. And that's my concern.
Yeah, and I don't mean to begrudge those that prefer to use an iPad. It's just, it's hard for me to understand why that's better. I mean, other than the mobility, which is pretty much unequivocal, I just don't get why that's better. And I think what I really should be saying is that for me, it's not better. And I don't mean to begrudge that it is better for Mike or Federico or anyone else. I'm just saying for me, it's hard for me to wrap my head around why that would be better. And I think, Marco, you made a great point that a lot of that relates to the fact that now I'm living in Xcode. Previously, I was living in VMware Fusion. That's my day-to-day job, whereas for a lot of these people, that's not their job.
Well, also, you know, what I said earlier, all the action in the App Store, like all the action in apps is happening on iOS right now. Like, If you make use of, you know, cool new modern apps to do pretty much anything, to do different workflows, maybe you're doing like photo editing and you want to use like cool plugins and effects and everything, all of that action is happening on iOS. iOS, if you want to play games ever, games on the Mac are kind of miserable most of the time. Like, all of the action for cool new apps that are being developed, cool new workflows, cool new things you can do with your computer, most of that is happening on iOS. Most of it's on the iPhone in particular, but some of that's also getting to the iPad. On the Mac, you know, there's no action to be had. You know, Mac apps are seemingly either like in stasis or dying. Like you have like, you know, Aperture gone. you know, Logic and Final Cut are like barely supported. You have third-party apps that are kind of withering on the vine a lot of the times. It's tough. It's a little scary to be a Mac user right now, as we see kind of a big part of the world moving on. You know, a big part of Apple's and third-party developers' efforts moving to other places.
What you said before about the iPad, like, you do think that eventually their attention will go elsewhere, like it's in the sun now with like the iPad Pro, but that eventually they'll lose interest again, because, you know, the early in the iPad's hit life, it was basically like a less important version of iOS that didn't have many iPad specific features for several years, and that may be the case. But I have to think that Apple overall as a company had one of its goals that it has to have somewhere on its big list of like multi-year goals is to do what it normally does and be the company that cannibalizes the Mac. So they see the Mac with no big growth potential. They see it as another market that could potentially be cannibalized by other markets. Like, it's small, these other markets are growing. Apple's whole thing is, we want to be the ones to cannibalize the Mac. You know, we want to be the ones to cannibalize the iPod by replacing it with the iPhone. Because if we don't do it, someone else will eventually, because if whatever thing that we're talking about being cannibalized does not have a very big growth trajectory, eventually, whatever size it is, will be dwarfed by whatever the next big thing is. So Apple is kind of in the business of, well, okay, well, let's figure out what that next big thing is, because if we just do nothing, someone else will do it for us. And the iPad and the emphasis on the iPad Pro is one effort to do that. Hey, if the Mac's going to be cannibalized, let us do it. I've always said that the iPad has the potential to be the thing that replaces the Mac if given enough attention and if its capabilities are extended, and the iPad Pro could be like the very, very beginning of that process. But say it doesn't work out. So they try to cannibalize the Mac with the iPad Pro and it doesn't work. If the iPad loses Apple's attention, I think it will be because they have another idea of a thing that's going to cannibalize the Mac. And they only have a certain number of shots at this idea of what's going to cannibalize the Mac before someone else does it for them. But I think that Apple as a company does not want some other thing made by some other non-Apple company to be the thing that finally makes the Mac irrelevant. I think Apple wants to make the Mac irrelevant. And right now, is the iPad is the thing that's doing that. So I have to think that attention is going to be paid to the iPad until either something else makes the Mac irrelevant, as in not an Apple product, or until Apple gives up on the iPad doing that and decides that it needs another solution. I don't think there is any long-term where 60 years from now, the Mac soldiers on pretty much exactly as it is. I just don't see that happening. So my hope is that Apple figures out what to replace the Mac with. And I think the iPad line has the potential to do that if enhanced in all the ways that we've discussed in past shows, in terms of larger screens, iPads that aren't really particularly portable, way more capabilities in iOS, figuring out the whole file situation, so on and so forth.
I think you're probably right long term, on an infinite time scale thing. You're probably right. But I have a hard time seeing how iOS gets from here to there. And technically, you know, like on a low level, like on an API level, on a kernel level and everything, you're probably right that like the next major version of Mac OS is probably an iOS derivative. And I don't know when that's coming out and whether that'll be good, but like, I think what replaces Mac OS eventually will indeed be a version of iOS. And we will just have large iOS devices with keyboards and mice, I guess. I don't know. I mean, probably, you know, but and that would also solve my UIKit problem with, you know, UIKit versus AppKit kind of thing. But I don't know. There's so much distance between iOS today and what it would have to be even a basic macOS replacement, that I have a hard time seeing that happening, just because the distance is so great. And maybe that's just short-sighted of me. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it may not have to be an equivalent for you, but like when you're retired or dead, it just needs to have the capabilities of the people who grew up in the generation that grew up with iOS devices find acceptable to do. Like the same kind of things you're doing now, developing software, like, I don't know, you know, whatever it is that you're doing with your Mac that you feel like you can only do on your Mac, all that needs to happen is there needs to be a generation of customers who feel like they can best do that on some tablet-type device. Whether or not you can best do that on a tablet-type device doesn't really matter. You just need the capabilities need to be there. It's like Casey was saying about mic. Well, the mic finds the iPad experience superior in ways that Casey doesn't understand. I can understand some of them in terms of just the simplicity, and there's fewer things that can go wrong on an iOS device, and there's fewer things to worry about or whatever, and also that things feel better sometimes in terms of just like body gesture or touching the screen or using a pen or whatever. And those can go a long way towards covering up the fact that you're actually, it takes more steps, or it's less efficient, or it's, you know, it's not as straightforward as it would be on the Mac or whatever. But I'm totally willing to give the iPad Pro and that type of thing a shot, because like Apple has just barely scratched the surface. They just now divided the screen up into two pieces. Like that's the level they're at, right? They've just now offered you an actual keyboard that you can attach to the thing. Like this is the babiest of baby steps. Like they just now gave you a stylus, which is a thing that has not really taken off on the Mac, but it offers a new angle. So I'm willing to give that a few years. It's not a slam dunk, but I think there is a fruitful avenue of pursuit there. And what they're pursuing again is not the phone, obviously. What they're pursuing is, if the Mac is going to go away or be replaced with something, we think it might be this, and then we would benefit, because it's like, well, fine, Mac shrinks, iPad Pro grows, all that money goes to Apple, the iPad gets on a better growth trajectory or whatever. If that turns out not to be the case, at least have it be from, you know, that not because you didn't put money into it, because like for the first several years of the iPad, it was, if Apple almost is like they thought, if we make a tablet device, that's all we have to do, and then instantly it will become the new future of personal computing. It's like, no, you got to actually put more effort into it than that, otherwise people are going to keep using Macs. So I feel like the Mac is safe for a long time, just because even if Apple is 100% right, it will take them a long time to figure out all the ins and outs, and probably the Mac will last for all of our active careers or whatever, but when we're in our dotage and retired, don't be surprised if we're looking at grandkids on a big iPad Pro screen.
Thanks to our three sponsors this week, Fracture, Squarespace, and Hover. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC. USA Syracuse, it's accidental. They didn't mean to. Accidental. Tech podcast, so long.
So, John, let me ask you something. Have you ever been to Las Vegas? And if not, how badly do you want to go?
You know the answers to both of those questions.
I did that more for my own laughter.
So as I was in Vegas last weekend, and Casey, as you are headed to Vegas in a few days, I hope that you consider while you're there, as I did while I was there, what it would be like to see John Syracuse in Vegas and the state of mind he would be in to be sitting there. I felt so bad for him even not being there. Like, just, I felt so bad for theoretical Syracuse in Vegas. Like, that, oh my God, he would be so miserable. Not to mention the flight on the way there, but, you know, my God, to see him in any part of Las Vegas would be both sad and incredible.
It's not my cup of tea, but I'm not a miserable person. Like, I would find, like, they have food there, right? At the very least, I would find some kind of food that I could eat that I would like. Like, you know, how could you not? There's got to be a million different restaurants there that make some kind of hopefully good food. I mean, I wouldn't be interested in gambling. Smoking is disgusting. I don't like lots of people. Like, yeah, there's not a lot there for me. But if I was stuck there, there are a lot of restaurants, right? So I could find something.
There are excellent restaurants. However, many of them require walking through a smoky casino to get to.
Yeah, that's pretty gross.
Delightful. Did you end up or down against the house?
Down by roughly $100.
That's not bad.
It not only is that not bad, but that was after three nights, and a lot of that was given out as tips to the dealers.
Well, you were up 50% the last time I heard, and you were like, maybe I need to stop now, but apparently you didn't.
I was up 40% after the first night, but then, you know, the second night was way down, and then the third night was kind of even.
Right, but you said after that, night that you were up, you mused to yourself, I believe, in Slack, maybe I should just quit while I'm ahead, he said, and then didn't.
Yes, I mean, gambling is always, you know, in hindsight, gambling is very easy.
No, it wasn't hindsight. It was current, right then sight. You had that insight immediately at the time, not later, not the next day. You didn't say, boy, I really should have quit when I was up 40%. When you were up, you said, maybe I should quit now.
I did say that, but then I wouldn't have had as much fun the next two nights because I wouldn't have had that activity. So it's like I paid that money for an activity. You know, and I mean, you know, most of the games that you can gamble on in Vegas, you know, the odds are always in favor of the house, but the percentage that they're in favor of the house by is usually not that big. And so if you kind of bet responsibly, and you don't make really huge bets or like make like accelerating bets to try to like win back your money. Like my strategy was very simple. I bet the same amount of money on every bet I took. I was playing to play, not to win a bunch of money, because I know that the chances of winning a bunch of money were very, very low. So simple as that, you know, it was a fun activity and it served its purpose. And I paid about $100 for three nights, and that includes tips and that includes all the free drinks I got at the time. So I think that's actually pretty good for my first gambling experience.
Not bad.
Actually, that was my second gambling experience. My first gambling experience was in college when I discovered that online blackjack existed. And I put $20 of real money into online blackjack in college, lost it in about 10 minutes, and was like, well, I'm an idiot. That was dumb. I didn't do it again.
Never again.
Yeah. Because that's not really a lot of fun. That's a very short time to lose all your money. And it just, yeah, it wasn't. That one was, it didn't have the same appeal.
It would have been better if someone smoked a cigarette next to you while you did it.